Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
She was just with a whole bunch of her friends, supposedly. Now, as the years have gone by, I kind of feel like it was a setup that she was made to be going out that night to deal with whatever was going on.
The missing and the unknown and the no closure, it's a constant grief. It never goes away. It doesn't get any better. I mean, it might get a little bit lighter as the years go on, but it's still really hard not knowing. And that's what hurts the most.
It's been over 30 years. I'm done. I'm not going to play games anymore.
I think it can be solved. I think it's going to be very difficult. And as time goes on, it gets harder and harder.
It's crazy that it's been 30 years because it's a lifetime. Like, we're all mothers now. I can only imagine 30 seconds, never mind 30 years of not knowing where my child was. But Jen would have called. And it took me many, many, many years, I'm going to say close to like 20 years probably, to accept the fact that she probably was murdered, because I always held out hope.
On the evening of November 14th, 1989, 16-year-old Jennifer Fay left her home in Brockton, Massachusetts. Her plan was to go hang out with some friends. Jennifer had been due to babysit that evening, but she really wanted to go to a party instead. So she asked her cousin to come over and babysit for her. Jennifer's cousin saw her leave the residence for the last time around 10 p.m. A mother of one of Jennifer's friends said that she stopped by at their house along her way that night. There was another sighting of her at a local convenience store in town, where she was seen with another teenager. Another lead was that the teen she was with became sick while they were walking and decided to go home, and that Jennifer was last seen walking toward a vehicle. No one is quite sure where Jennifer went that night or who she may have been with. Jennifer's family has been searching for answers since the following morning, when they awoke to find Jennifer missing, but all of the leads that they've uncovered seem to have gone cold. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 256 of The Vanished, Jennifer Fay's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. 16-year-old Jennifer Fay was a lively young woman who was known to be a bit of a wild child. She enjoyed hanging out with her friends and going to local parties in the neighborhood. We spoke to Jennifer's younger sister, Yvette, who told us about some of her memories of Jennifer.
She was 16. I was 11. She was born on Christmas Day in 1972. She was the life of the every room she walked in. She was just so full of energy and life, and she was so funny, big jokester. She was mean to me a lot, but in a funny way, I guess. She was 5 years older than me, but, you know, I was the little sister, the little tag-along, so she kind of couldn't stand it at some points, but there were days that, you know, I remember her being nice, like we'd be sitting out on the porch on a summer day and eating a popsicle, and she never
for some reason, never, ever, ever finished her popsicle. She always gave it to me. I remember that like it was yesterday. It's just, I don't know, it's weird. It's something that's always stuck with me every time she had, you know, those popsicles, they had the two sticks in them. You could break them apart. And sometimes your parents would only give you one side, but sometimes they'd give you both. She always just always gave it to me. She was really special. She was the life of everybody's gatherings.
We also spoke to Jennifer's cousin, Tammy, who was one of the last known people to interact with Jennifer. She told us more about her cousin.
She was bubbly. She was happy. She was always like the life of the party. She always made you laugh. She had lots of friends. As soon as she walked into a room, she was noticed. You know, and she just had that, or you just noticed her. And not because of anything. Like, she wasn't a stuck-up person. She was just a fun person. She got along with everybody. Like, she was just good. Like, it's just sad that she's not here.
We also spoke to Jennifer's mom, Dottie. And she echoed the same sentiments about Jennifer, but also added that she felt some aspects of Jennifer's personality may have made her more vulnerable.
She was a sweetheart. Jennifer loved everybody, and she was very bubbly. She was a typical teenager, you know, unfortunately trusting people that she shouldn't have trusted, but she trusted everybody, Jen. Everybody was a friend, and she had a lot of friends. She was just very family-oriented. She loved to have all the family over, and we would always have her birthday on Christmas Eve because she was born Christmas Day, so everybody already had plans for Christmas Day, so we would have a Christmas Eve birthday party for her. We made it special, and she loved her brother and sister. Of course, she fought with them like every siblings do, but Jennifer just really trusted a lot of people that, unfortunately, I think, ended up being a part of her disappearing.
Jennifer struggled in school, and it was a struggle for her family to keep her going to school. Yvette told us that Jennifer preferred working.
Jen kind of hated school. She repeated the ninth grade like two or three times before she just kind of said screw it and just started working more and wanting to do, you know, whatever she wanted to do in life. She really hated going to school. She'd much rather, you know, go out and work. And at the time that she disappeared, I can't remember if she had a job or not. I do know that her last job before she did disappear was at Orange Julius down at the Brockton Mall.
Jennifer's cousin Tammy told us her perspective on Jennifer getting into some trouble for skipping school and running away.
I guess she was skipping school a lot. She had run away a few times. Her parents were going through a divorce. So I don't know if that might have had a lot to do with it. She just liked to do her own, didn't like to be told what to do. She just liked doing her own thing. She just wanted to be free and live her life the way she wanted to live it. Her dad was strict. That uncle or that father, that somebody that just always, you just always were scared to walk in a room with because they just there of the way they talked or made you tense. And that's how my Uncle Jim was. Like, just always made me nervous. Like, walking in there, he was just like stern. So I don't know if they were like, when she started becoming a teenager, they started butting heads. And again, he had moved out at a certain point. I know it was before Jen went missing, but I don't remember exactly how long. They were separated and he wasn't living in the home anymore when Jen went missing.
November 14th, 1989 was an unseasonably warm fall day in New England. It had been in the high 60s earlier in the day. Jennifer went out that evening to hang out with her friends. As the chilly air settled in, Jennifer returned home to grab a jacket. That was the last time that Jennifer's family saw her. Yvette explained what she knows about the day Jennifer disappeared.
She went out to a so-called party, which, I mean, at that time, all the kids called any kind of gathering a party. It was a Tuesday night. Something was going on. I'm not sure. Maybe just a gathering, but they called it a party. What I've been told that there was two different parties that she had gone to that night in the same vicinity. She was supposed to be babysitting us. My parents were out, and she had called my cousin Tammy and had her come over and babysit us while she went out. And I remember that was around 9 o'clock at night. And I remember her coming back home between 10 and 10:30 to get a jacket. And that's the last I ever heard. I actually didn't even see her. I heard her voice. Because I was in the next room.
when she came back home, she had grabbed her Iron Maiden jacket, which it was November 14th. It was freezing out. I remember because my best friend Jen was actually over my house and I had walked her halfway home at like 7 o'clock at night. I remember it was cold that night. I believe she made it to the party, but she never made it back home. My mom had called the house to check up on, you know, make sure me and my little brother were in bed and everything was all right. My cousin Tammy answered the phone and my mom just got really scared and came home. And, you know, we never saw her again. She never came home. I believe that whatever happened to her that night within the early hours of the next day. I believe she was gone.
Tammy is several years older than Yvette and the person that Jennifer had asked to babysit in her place. She told us what she remembers of Jennifer coming back to the house with a friend to pick up her jacket.
She came in to go to the bathroom. As she was coming out, because she had these overalls on, but the overalls you could take the suspender pads off and just tuck the flap in your front, like in just warm like jeans. And she had those on, so she was tucking her shirt into that, like when she came out of the bathroom and she was tucking the flap back in and asked if I wanted to go with her. And I said, no, I had to get home. And they left and they walked out the door together. And I didn't think even to watch her leave because I didn't think I'd never see her. You know what I mean? I didn't get any vibe that I'd never see her again or anything. So they just left. Aunt Dottie had called me the next morning and said, asked me if I seen her or whatever, anything. And I said, no. And then, like I said, she had run away a few times. So, the first few days, I didn't think, like, we would never see her. You know what I mean? I thought she'd be home. And days turned into weeks. Weeks turned into months. Months turned into years. And here we are. We're going to be on 31 years coming up. But that night when I spoke, she was heading down to Broad Place. That's the only place I knew that they partied. There was another party on Montello Street that I didn't know about. I guess the girls used to go in there and hang out. And then one of the boys got their own, a couple of guys got their own apartment in a building that faced the front part of Montello Street. And I guess there had been a party there too at that same night, but I wasn't aware of that. I wasn't really part of the clique because I didn't drink or smoke. So I really wasn't part of their, like, them going out and hanging out and doing stuff like that.
Jennifer's mom, Dottie, was out the evening that her daughter disappeared. We often hear people talk about mother's intuition, and Dottie told us how she got an unsettling feeling that night.
I had asked her to babysit. Well, I told her she was going to babysit, and she didn't really want to, and I said, oh, you're going to babysit, blah, blah, blah. So I went out, and while I was out, I don't know. This is so strange, and I wish I had mentioned it in the beginning, because while I was out, I just got this strange feeling over me. It's like they call mother's intuition or something. You know something's wrong. I got that feeling over me, so I called the house. And when I called the house, my niece answers the phone, Tammy, and said that, no, Jennifer went out and she asked her to babysit. So I said, okay. So I ended up going home and no Jennifer.
Jennifer had a history of running away. So at first, her family thought that she would turn up in the next couple of days. When that didn't happen, they called the police to report Jennifer missing. Here's Yvette.
She did sort of, I guess you could say, run away a lot. She didn't actually, like, run away, though. She would always go to a friend or a family member's house, and she would keep in contact with us every day and let us know where she was. My mom was like that. Even just going down the street, my mother would be like, you know, call me when you get there, be home at this time, check in. Nobody knew where she was, no family members or anything. So it was about maybe four days to a week to where we called the Brockton Police Department. And they had told us to not touch anything in her room, that they were going to take the dogs down to the house and sniff around and all that jazz. And no one ever came. No one ever showed up. No dogs, no police, nothing. They just kind of chalked her up as a runaway right away, because she had done it a couple times. Like, my mom had even gone as far as putting chins on her at one point, which is like, you have to go to school, you have to be at home by a certain time. Like, it's kind of like a curfew kind of thing with parents and the courts and stuff like that.
When Jennifer disappeared, it was the 80s and the kids in her neighborhood liked to party. There were teens that were close to Jennifer's age and also some who were a little older, and could legally buy alcohol for the teenagers. These parties would pop up around the neighborhood, in someone's yard, apartment, or basement. Yvette told us where the known parties were on the night Jennifer disappeared.
It's Broad Street. Broad Place, they call it Broad Place. It's right, like if you were standing on my front porch, you can just look straight down, and that road that went the same as mine, straight path, is where she hung out. So it wasn't far. And then I guess there was another party over at 750 Montello Street Apartments, which was kind of diagonally across the street from where I lived.
Jennifer's mom, Dottie, explained that in the days after Jennifer went missing, she began going to Jennifer's friends' homes. She wanted to ask if they had seen or heard anything about where her daughter could be. The reactions she got from Jennifer's longtime friends seemed odd to her, and she wasn't quite sure what to make of it.
When Jennifer went missing, I had gone to her friends and the neighbors and asked, you know, did you see her? Do you know anything? And they were very vague and didn't want to talk to me. And then, as you know, I mean, you know, you figure a week goes by, they don't want to say anything. Maybe she ran away. Because naturally, that's how the police took it anyway. 16 years old, she must have ran away. Okay. Well, I didn't believe that anyway, because, I mean, here it was. Thanksgiving was coming up. Her birthday was coming up. She wouldn't do that. That wasn't her. So I kept after them and kept after the Brockton police, and they just kept running with the idea that she ran away. And the fact that none of her friends wanted to come to me and ask me, did you hear from her? Did she come home? Can we do anything? Not a one of them. And these are friends in the neighborhood that Jennifer went to school with from kindergarten on to high school. So naturally, now I'm thinking, well, maybe they're afraid. They don't want to say. And I'm thinking, well, because Jennifer, you know, she would have a spat with me and she'd take off and go to her girlfriends. It wasn't a case of running away, really. She would just run out of the house and go over her girlfriends, and she would call me when she'd get there. Okay, you know, blow off your steam and then get your fanny home. Okay.
Jennifer's sister was also confused by the immediate distance between Jennifer's friends and their family. She told us about one friend who worked at a local market.
And as soon as Jen went missing, none of them would talk to us again. Like, she used to work at the Rice's Market right up the street from my house, 2 seconds up the street. She used to work there, and I used to see her every day, and we would talk every day. And then right after Jen went missing, it was like she walked up the street with her hoodie up, head down, never said a word to us. Nobody ever came by or called or anything to see if we had heard from Jen. So that was an automatic, you know, red flag for me.
Dottie also remembered this friend's strange behavior.
One of them, I think, worked in Rice's Market at the time, which was the store at the end of my street. You know, I would see her, she'd get very nervous. They would go the opposite way if they saw me, or my mother even. Like I say, that's why in the beginning, you naturally think her being a teenager and her friends not wanting to come around and ask what happened or if you found her, that they knew something. That went on for quite a while. And
we all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, and you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that.
Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. Tammy told us about those first several days after Jennifer disappeared and what the family did to look for her.
She wasn't angry about anything. She wasn't mad about anything. So there was no, like, reason for her not to come back. You know what I mean? Like, there was no argument at that day. So anything to give her, anybody a reason that she wouldn't be come, like, she wouldn't have been home. But I think just because she had run away a few times, that's what everybody at first assumed. And we all, I mean, everybody looked for her and drove different places. And my uncle was always, my Uncle Bobby, he's actually one that found her a few times and brought her home, or someone that she would call and he'd bring her home. But he was out an awful lot driving around looking for her, and he didn't find her any of the spots that he had found her before. When she had run away, she had been gone up to a week, 3 days, like up to a week. I don't know exactly whose house she was staying at, but it happened, I'd say, like at least 2 to 3 times prior to her going missing. And I think it was just because her and my aunt might have gotten to an argument and she decided to take off, or she didn't like to be home at a certain time because a lot of the kids didn't have curfews. In the neighborhood where she lived, there was always people down the block at Broad Place. They were always drinking or smoking or doing something. And I just think that just didn't want to be home at a certain time. And like I said, my aunt was going through a divorce, so she needed Jen to help, you know what I mean, a little bit more, because it was my first time my aunt had ever been on her, I think, on her own. She'd always had my Uncle Jim or something. So I think she just really relied on Jen a little more to help her take care of the little ones or be more responsible. And I just don't think either Jen wasn't ready or didn't want to do it.
Jennifer had another friend, Kristen, who several people told us was Jennifer's very best friend. Her behavior after Jennifer disappeared was also puzzling. And later, her family did an interview on the news, sharing new information about seeing Jennifer the night she disappeared. Here's Yvette again.
Kristen was her best friend. She doesn't talk at all. I went to Kristen's house not even 2 weeks after Jen went missing so that I could face-to-face talk with her. And the reason why it was 2 weeks is because another one of her friends, Michelle, told me not to go down there by myself. Now, at this time, you have to remember, I was only 11 years old, but I was also a little nut. So those people didn't scare me at all. I had gotten into fights with Kristen before, so I mean, I wasn't afraid of her. She was only 2 years older than me, too. She was 2 years older than me, 2 years younger than Jen. So it wasn't really any big deal for me to talk to Kristen. I wasn't afraid of her. But for some reason, Michelle wouldn't let me go down there and talk to her alone. And I didn't know why. The whole time I was there, which was a good hour, in her backyard, she was sitting at the picnic table with her head down. She never looked at me. She never answered any of my questions. I don't know why. She never even talked to me at all. She just let me sit there and ask questions and scream at her. And Michelle wouldn't let me near her because obviously I was very frustrated. I was going to take violence into play with her. Michelle wouldn't let me near her. I want to say a couple years later, her and her mom did an interview. I don't know if it was with Channel 7 or Channel 5. It was one of those. But her mom, Dee Dee, which hung out with my parents too. Now, Dee Dee used to be at my house all the time. The first time my sister smoked a joint with any adult was with Kristen's mother, Dee Dee. So she was no saint. On the news, she said, and Kristen didn't even talk either. Dee Dee did all the talking for her. But on the news, Dee Dee said that Jen showed up at her house around 11:30 to get Kristen to come back out because she was just with her. And Dee Dee said, "Kristen, sleep in. She's going to school tomorrow. And you smell like booze." She said she smelled like coffee brandy. So she sent her out. She sent her away and said, go home. Now, that doesn't make any sense because Kristen was just with her. So she definitely wasn't in bed sleeping. Dee Dee was a drinker and a partier and did drugs. So there would have been no reason for Dee Dee to say to my sister, "No, you smell like coffee brandy. You got to go." That's not making any sense with me either. I mean, she smoked weed with the girls. And all of it makes no sense. And I feel as if Kristen knows a lot more. It wasn't her house the party was at. It was just kind of like the block that the party was at outside. But a lot of times they did hang out in her basement or her backyard and party. I was told by everybody that she was there that night. She won't talk at all. I mean, I just don't understand why she's never come to any of the vigils if she was Jen's best friend. She's never come to any of the benefits, none of the fundraisers. She peeks out the window every time we walk by, every year when we walk by her house. Like I said, I never talked to her again after that day in her backyard. Never saw her again. I don't understand why she's still living there. And I just feel like something happened at that house. I feel like they're lying. This is why. My Aunt Debbie went down there a couple of years after Jen went missing. And she went there and she went in the house. And Dee Dee wasn't home, Kristen's mother. It was Kristen's aunt that was at the house visiting. Kristen's aunt let my Aunt Debbie in the house. And then they got to talking. And Kristen's aunt had said to her, "Oh, what's your name again?" And she said, "Deborah Fay." And as soon as she said Fay, my aunt said that the woman's face turned ghostly white. And she was like, "You got to go. You got to get out of here. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry." So that's just another red flag. The PIs, they suspect a family that's right near Kristen's house, the house that the second party was at, the backyards adjoin. They meet each other.
Yvette told us about one theory that's emerged in Jennifer's case.
Jen hung around with a lot of different people. There's a lot of different acquaintances she had that she maybe called her friends. She was very trusting. She hung out with an older crowd too, a couple years older than her, and partied with a lot of them. And what I think happened is she maybe saw something that she wasn't supposed to see, and they wanted to keep her quiet because my sister, even though she was this little tiny little thing that I used to call Skeletor, she just had a big mouth. She didn't care what anyone thought or any of that. Like if she saw something that she seen was bad, she was going to say something about it. She would have spoke up about it. And I believe that's what happened. I mean, at the time, there was a family in Brockton that was going through some things. What they did was they had this girl staying with them. She was like supposedly mentally challenged, and they were getting a check for her, you know, to take care of her, stuff like that. What they were doing, well, the mother, she was abusing her, just basically wanted the check for this girl. And I don't know what kind of hell this girl went through, but I honestly think that my sister saw something happen to her in that house. And I don't think my sister ever left that house alive. This crazy lady, Diana Natale, she's the mom of all the boys that my sister and my whole family hung out with. And I grew up with them too. Basically took in this girl, Rena, but they were locking her in like this little room area underneath the stairs at their house that they lived in Brockton. And they were abusing her, neglecting her, all that stuff. Well, years later, when they moved to Halifax, where they were caught for it all, she was again in the basement in a locked room. The reason why Diana Natale got charged for what she got charged for was because the lock wasn't on the inside of the door. It was on the outside of the door. And when they went in, there was like this slab metal table that they had like a nasty cushion, like a nasty mattress on top of. And that was Rena's bed. And they gave her a bucket that she was able to go to the bathroom in. And she was allowed to go out into the woods and dump her bucket out there. And that was it. Well, my cousin, he was at a party at the Halifax house. He had come in contact with Rena and seen what was going on. And after he left the house, he couldn't take what he had saw going on. So he called authorities and they went in and They actually found her in the woods with scratches and bruises and all kinds of stuff all over her. I guess what Rena told the officer that found her was that they were, Diane and Natalie was whipping her with sticks and tools and stuff, like just beating her with tools and sticks and stuff. They shaved her head. She looked like something out of a concentration camp when they grabbed her, when they finally got her out of there.
This theory sounded like a strange twist, but Tammy told us more about what she knows of this family.
This is just my opinion, but this Diana Talley lady, she was a very vicious person. Her and her family had let this girl stay with them that was kind of mentally challenged. She was older, but her mind wasn't older. Her mind was like a little girl. My brother had gone to a graduation party at their house. He was there and they thought it was a cool thing to bring everybody at the party downstairs. And this little girl was in this locked in room in the basement, like a little room with just a mattress or a blanket on the floor with a bucket, used it for the bathroom. It had come out that girl had been beat. She had been raped. They had done mentally so much stuff to her. And I think that so many people in that area are still scared of Diane Talley and what she could do.
News reports from 1993 indicate that Diana Natalie Miller, along with a man who was living in her home, were charged with kidnapping and multiple counts of assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. The two later pleaded guilty after authorities found that they were keeping a woman captive in their basement. Prosecutors believe that Diana became the guardian of this young woman to collect her social security checks, and that she was forced to do chores around the house. If she didn't do the chores to their liking, she was beaten. When she was found, she was covered in welts and cuts and had been suffering from malnutrition, requiring medical attention and years of therapy. The details of the abuse the victim endured were horrific. Authorities only learned about this after there was a party for one of Diana's sons, and he took friends down to the basement to show off the girl. One of Diana's sons, Greg Natalie, was later charged with beating the victim with a whip. He pleaded guilty and received a suspended sentence. According to a June 23, 1993 article in the Boston Globe, people in the neighborhood had seen the victim over the years. She was sometimes sent to run errands at the local store. Some came forward and claimed to have seen Diana's sons taunt the young woman and slap her around. There has been some speculation that the victim in this case was also sexually exploited by members of the family and also by others outside of the family. While I could find no concrete evidence of this in my research, looking at Diana and her husband's backgrounds, there is some startling information. According to a June 19, 1993 article in the Boston Globe, Diana's husband, Bruce Miller, had been convicted of deriving support from prostitution, soliciting, and keeping a house of ill fame, which means running a house of prostitution or a brothel. Diana also had a history of prostitution-related crimes, larceny, being a disorderly person, and assaulting and threatening to kill a neighbor. During our research into this case, we heard many, many disturbing stories about things that occurred inside that home. As horrible as this twist in the story is, we have to wonder where Jennifer fits into all of this. She was known to hang out with Diana's sons. One theory is that Jennifer saw something at their house and was going to tell the police, or that Jennifer could have been victimized by these people too. We know that several years after Jennifer disappeared, one of the sons was brazen enough to show the victim off to friends at a party. It seems like this violence was normalized within their home. Is it just a coincidence that someone in Jennifer's neighborhood had kidnapped a disabled young woman and held her captive in their basement? Someone that not only lived in the same neighborhood, but her children were also friends with Jennifer? It could simply be a coincidence, but no one can be certain. Yvette told us about a phone call she had with Diana.
A couple years ago, or maybe a year ago now, I did talk to Diana Natalie on the phone. Don't ask me why I did it, but I did. And she was basically telling me that I was crazy, that I was blaming her for my sister's disappearance when I should be looking at my own family. I never knew her or her family. I was like, I don't know what you're talking about, lady. Your kids were at my house all the time. I'm like, your youngest son, Keith, he was my best friend. He was at my house all the time. I was at your house all the time. I don't know why you're saying I don't know you people. She actually told my Nana, before my Nana passed, years ago, she told my Nana, yeah, your granddaughter's buried in my effing backyard underneath my pool. Horrible, horrible people.
Jennifer's cousin Tammy told us about her interactions with Diana Natale.
We were always friends with Natale's, not the mother. She was crazy. Like, she would cuss you out. She's an evil person. Still to this day, she has contacted me through numerous fake profiles to say the most disgusting things to me and act like she's not her, but we all know it's her. I call her Sybil because she's made so many different fake profiles. And she's always in groups saying how her sons never hung with Jennifer. They didn't know Jennifer. They didn't play with Jennifer, which is a bald-faced lie because Jennifer and Keithy, who has passed away, he was in an accident years ago. They went to Raymond school together. No, I think it was Robbie, sorry. Greg Natale and Jennifer date, like, kind of had a puppy love thing, like a junior high thing, but they would call it to the boyfriend and girlfriend. And I also, it sickens me to say now, because I believe he's one of all, but I also dated Richie Natale on and off since eighth grade. And I was in their house a few times, and so was Jennifer. I don't know if she's put the fear of God in people. I don't know if it's her. So the one person I would expect to open their mouth would be Kristen, because like I said, her and you would never see one without the other. If you saw Jennifer, you saw Kristen.
Even though many of Jennifer's friends have been silent over the years, we were able to track down a couple of her friends to get their perspective. We spoke to her friend Cheryl, who told us her thoughts on Jennifer's disappearance and the things she was doing around that time.
I met her at high school. My sister was friends with her, so I met her through my sister. We're 11 months and 5 days apart, my sister and I. I was a year behind them in school. But when I got to the high school as a freshman, they were supposed to be sophomores, but they were freshmen again. So we all were friends and in the same circle and hung out together. And she was a spitfire. She was amazing. She was just always happy, always happy. She was friends with everybody. And she was tiny, 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 tiny. She was like 90 pounds soaking wet, skinny, blonde hair. And she was just like the life of the party. She was always happy. She was friends with everybody. She was never, you know, in a bad mood or mean or negative or anything. But like at that time, Jen was considered a habitual runaway. And she wasn't, though. Like if she got punished and there was, you know, something going on that weekend, she ran away to go to the party or whatever was going on. But it was never like a runaway. We always knew where she was. She would half the time be with me, you know what I mean, at my house and stuff, or with Kristen down the street or something. She didn't like run away and not have contact and disappear, not to be heard from or seen. So the fact that Brockton police like to label everyone as a habitual runaway is just wrong. And then people, you know, try to label her as promiscuous, which I, again, disagree with that. She was a freshman in high school. You know, she was 16. She wasn't promiscuous. You know, you kiss a lot of boys when you're that age. You know, it doesn't mean that you're out sleeping with them just because you think he's cute and you kissed him. And it's high school relationships. They're not supposed to last for months and years. You know, that's how people grow up. You date someone, you break up, and then you're dating somebody else. You know, she wasn't sleeping with them, as people try to label and say. And then people try to say she was like a drug addict or this or that. No, she wasn't. She smoked weed. We all did. We were freshmen in high school. We smoked weed. We maybe have some drinks at parties, what kids are doing these days. You know what I mean? But now it's in a different form. Now it's in a vape form. But we went to parties. We smoked weed. We would drink beers. Yes, maybe, you know, there'd be some acid done or whatever. But it wasn't. She wasn't a raging drug addict like people tried to label. At the vigil, rather, there's only three friends that show up. Myself, my sister, and Michelle Fairbanks. We're the only three friends that show up every single year. We're the only three friends that are still in contact with the family that have never left or disappeared. Everyone else, you know, might make a comment on a social media post or whatever, but you have to take it with a grain of salt.
Cheryl told us how she learned that Jennifer was missing.
My mother came in our bedroom to wake us up. And I will never, never forget it. She opened the bedroom door and said, where is she? Like, that's how she woke us up. It wasn't, you know, wake up, time to get up, time for school thing. She opened the bedroom door And she said, where is she? And we woke up, we're like, what? What are you talking about? And she goes, where is she? Her mother's on the phone. She's worried sick. And I was like, what are you talking about? She goes, Jennifer, where's Jen? Her mother's on the phone. She's worried sick. And I remember looking across to my sister who was in her bed. And we both just looked at each other. And I knew right then something was wrong because there was no reason for Jen to run away, as they label it, or disappear. There was absolutely none. There was no fighting going on at home, or she wasn't unhappy. There was no party that she was going to miss because she was grounded. There was nothing. It was a school night. You know what I mean? She wanted to go to her friend, Kristen, if you can even, I wouldn't even call her a friend now, but there was a little party at Kristen's house, a neighborhood, you know, get together that she wanted to go to. So I knew right then that something was wrong, because if Jen had truly ran away, she would have called us or been with us. So I knew right then something was definitely wrong, because we didn't know. We didn't talk to her. There was no reason for her to take off for the night or to do anything. And we hadn't spoken to her, so we knew that something was definitely wrong. When an hour becomes a day, becomes 2 days, going to school, nobody's heard from her, nobody's seen her, talking to our other friend. And then Kristen, like, had nothing to say from the get-go, from day one, nothing. And it was just odd. And then my mother, years after, my mother said, you know, I hate to say this, but I'm so glad I didn't let you go that night, because she fears we could have been gone missing too. And my response was always, but I wish you had, because Jen wouldn't have gone missing, because we would have been with her. We wouldn't have left her alone in a bad spot like people that were with her, is, you know, how you feel.
We also spoke to Cheryl's sister, Sharon, and she told us that after Jennifer disappeared, they had no clue what happened and waited for her every morning at school.
So we were from different sides of town. So when we would go to high school, we would always meet at a certain spot right in front of the gym at Brockton High, because we took two different buses. So I remember sitting there for like 2 weeks waiting for her, and because that's how we met every morning. I'd wait for her to get off our bus. We'd meet and then we'd go do whatever. And she just never showed up. We kind of never heard anything for a very long time. It was actually years before anybody even came to talk to us. I remember exactly when the detective on the case came to my mother's house looking to speak to my sister and I. My sister said to her, well, it's about fucking time. And this was several years after Jennifer had been gone missing. Nobody came to talk to us or anything. Years later, Brockton police just said she was, another runaway.
Cheryl and Sharon were just teenagers at the time, but they both felt like the police weren't doing enough to find their friend. So they kept looking for Jennifer on their own.
My sister and I used to go and do our own searches down the pits, the tracks, places where we used to hang out, look everywhere for anything, never found anything. Probably was pretty stupid looking back, putting ourselves out there in harm's way. But we reached out to Montel Williams when he used to have Sylvia Brown on all the time. We reached out to John Walsh, America's Most Wanted, like anything to try to get her name out there to see if somebody could help us, because we felt nobody was investigating it properly.
Cheryl told us her theories about what happened to Jennifer.
We think that it was somebody that she knew, somebody like in her neighborhood. We don't think it was somebody from school. We think it was somebody older, like from her neighborhood, that she knew socially and maybe partied with or something. And I feel like it was like a rape gone bad type of thing. I think somebody was probably, you know, hitting on her. Maybe she was flirting with them. She was, you know, she was a flirt. Maybe she did kiss them or something, but, you know, that's it. Doesn't mean it's everything. And I feel that they took it to mean more and tried for more. And she probably put up a fight. But she, like I said earlier, she was like 90 pounds soaking wet. And she was probably, you know, overtaken by somebody else's strength. And I think that I honestly feel it was like a rape gone bad. And then somebody did their best to cover their tracks. And initially, there were so many good leads. I feel maybe, well, I wouldn't even say initially. I'll say, you know, 15 years in when the investigators finally were brought on. And a lot of dead ends. But I mean, you know, you're talking a cold case 15 years or so later when they finally started investigating. But I feel that something definitely happened that night. And I feel like it was a rape gone bad by somebody in her neighborhood. There's like two people, one that has always been in the back of my mind that he had something to do with it. And it turns my stomach because years later, I would see this person in a social setting, and it just, like, turns my stomach, because what if, like, he had something to do with my friend's disappearance? The biggest thing is somebody does, like, something that we always say is someone somewhere knows something, and it's absolutely so true. And it is disgusting and disturbing that 30 years later, the majority of us are all parents now, you know? And whoever did this is still out there living their life. And, you know, it's going to be one of those things when it does finally come full circle and they are made to pay for whatever they've done, that people say, oh my God, I never knew. It's my neighbor. It's my son's football coach or basketball coach or whatever. You're right. Because 30 years ago, this is what they did. And now for the past 20 years, they could be your best friend and neighbor for the past 20 years, having barbecues together, your kids' birthday parties and everything. And they're a monster. Somebody knows something, and I can't stress enough, like, it is not our job to try to decipher what we think we know or don't know, or it's not a big deal, because whatever piece they may have that they think is not a big deal may be the missing piece to the puzzle that puts it all together. And it usually is the things that seem so illogical, like it doesn't make sense, it doesn't fit, it has nothing to do with this, but it may be that linking piece that they need. And I just think that everybody needs to just talk to the police, talk to the investigators, you know, and people just need to talk.
Cheryl's sister Sharon had some of the same thoughts and also some differing ones on the theories swirling around this case.
For a long time, I was dead set on the story that I had heard, you know, by people that I believe and rely on to know what they were talking about. But recently, something made me change my mind and went back to something else, which I had thought way back in the beginning. And I remember there was this person that I don't even know his name. I just remember one night we were all hanging out and there was this guy driving around in a white van. I don't even remember his name. He had dark hair. He was much older than us. I just remember we were all partying in his van one night. You know, and that's all I remember of him that particular night. But then I remember years later when the investigators came and they kept asking about him and asking about him and asking about him. So I was kind of like, all right. And then I let it go and I didn't think about it for like 20 years. And then just recently, within the last week, he keeps popping back in my head for some reason. And I don't know why. There were rumors that there was a mother from the neighborhood that didn't like Jennifer and that had, you know, Jennifer had walked in on her kids doing something rotten to people. So she wanted to take care of it before it got out of control. Meaning take care of it, meaning take care of Jennifer before she could go running her mouth to people. And, you know, it's just, there's been so many stories. So she would go out, she could go out and party with you, you being a man. And she was very flirtatious. And I could just see it going the wrong way. I could see somebody taking it the wrong kind of way and then just trying to propose something on her and her not going with it and them just overpowering her. I, in my heart, feel like that's what happened. I feel it was definitely a man that tried to pull something on her. She said no, and then they overpowered her. That's what I feel. I've always felt that. Just because that was her, though, too. She was silly, and she would make best friends with anybody, especially if she had had a couple of drinks or something. You know, she could make best friends in the bathroom for the night. She was just a friendly person. I think some people just took advantage of that. I think, especially, again, we're talking 30 years ago, the world was a different place.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. In the early 2000s, many years after Jennifer had disappeared, there was renewed interest in the case when a new group of investigators began working it. Yvette told us more.
We have over the years, through the Molly Bish Foundation, we met a couple of private investigators that donated their time. Like, they did the work pro bono on my sister's case. Who started it was Phil White. He was actually a Brockton detective himself, and he was retired, and he still wanted to do, you know, his work. So he got together a team of four people, including himself. So those five of them, we used to call them the Fay Five team. When he passed away, it just kind of dwindled off. A couple of them left. The private detectives have also gone all the way to South Carolina to interview people of interest. They were a good team when Phil was alive. Since he's passed, it's been pretty much downhill.
After years and years of investigation into this case by the police department, private detectives, and Jennifer's family, this is the best idea they have of her timeline for November 14th, 1989.
She went to the first party, came home to get her jacket, went to the second party, and then was last seen at Rice's Market, I guess, getting more beer or something with someone in a brown truck. And she was supposedly with her friend, and her friend had to leave her because he, I guess, was too intoxicated and got sick. That's the story. Anyways, I don't believe a word of it, but that's the story.
Dottie told us that she was hopeful that this group of investigators would uncover the truth about what happened to her daughter back in 1989. But that hope didn't come to fruition.
They spoke to over 250 people, so-called friends of Jennifer's in the neighborhood and acquaintances, and never got anything out of them. And as a matter of fact, when they did talk to them, they were pretty shaky, didn't want to say. So I believe that the neighborhood kids that Jen hung around with at that time probably do know something, whether or not they're afraid that what happened to Jennifer may happen to them, and that's why they don't want to come forward. You know, I mean, I can only speculate on that. And that's where we are today. I still don't know where my daughter is. I don't know what happened to her. I only know that she went out and never came home. And it's been hell. It really has.
We also had the opportunity to speak with Sergeant Corey from the Brockton Police Department. He told us a bit about his background.
My name is George Corey. I'm a sergeant with Brockton Police. I was hired for Brockton in 1995. It was shortly after I did 4 years in the military, which was the Army in particular. My father was a police officer here in Brockton for 36 years, retired, I believe, in 81. So I always had somewhat of an interest in law enforcement since I was a young child.
Sergeant Corey told us what he knows of the investigation into Jennifer's disappearance in the years before he began working the case.
She disappeared in 89, and I got on here in 95. So the file was at first investigated by a detective named Ann Desmond. And the best of my recollection, she was assigned
sometime after the disappearance in 89, but there's really not much documentation until 1997, somewhere around there. I think it's the earliest documentation I've actually found, besides the missing person report itself.
As you heard earlier, initially, Jennifer's family and the police believed that she had run away due to her history. Sergeant Corey told us how this has impacted the case.
Allegedly, she had some a history of running away, although it was nothing for a lengthy period of time. So I really can't answer for Ann or the family or what they did initially. In my opinion, I don't think it was taken too seriously in the beginning, early stages of her disappearance. That's just my opinion on it. I'm not throwing stones at anybody or blaming one person, but it definitely seems like there's a long lapse between her reported disappearance. Even the disappearance itself wasn't reported until a week after her disappearance. So you obviously want to get right on top of these disappearances, see when they're real. And then after that, I really can't find any investigative notes until 1997.
Sergeant Corey explained more about Jennifer's neighborhood back in 1989.
The whole neighborhood was quite the party. Probably every single person I've interviewed in this case was, you know, at a young age into drugs, into alcohol, such that that whole block that she lived in, definitely. Some were a lot older, but again, man, a lot of the family members were like super young during her disappearance. So how well do you know somebody as an 11, 12 year old? It's hard to give an opinion on somebody's life, really. It's at that age. What do you remember at that age? It's hard.
There are many stories from various witnesses that claim to have seen Jennifer on the night of her disappearance. But the problem is that they're not always consistent. Sergeant Corey explained this further.
It's no secret. It's that the last place she was somewhere on Broad Street by Broad Place. And there were some stories about her allegedly getting into a pickup truck. That was really never confirmed. There were other stories about a large size Cadillac that was there that she may have gotten into or was talking to. A lot of people like saw her the night of her disappearance. It was like half a dozen to a dozen people saw her like hours before her disappearance. But you know, we get just conflicting stories about where exactly she was the last time somebody saw her. And, you know, what kind of car was she, if she was, talking to? Was it a truck? Was it a car? Was it a Cadillac? We just get, the stories are just all over the place. And I think sometimes it's just a little bit of, like I said, right after that last, so many people say, oh, yeah, I saw her right here between this, that, and then all of a sudden it just goes dead. And nobody can really say, oh, it was so-and-so's car, and that's who she was talking to. So that's really where the dead end is. We definitely have a witness that was, we believe, was the last person to see her alive. But he's, like I said, that person is tough to talk to. Just put it that way. We definitely have some, I don't want to go into why, but there's definitely a small handful of people that we're most interested with in this case, definitely.
In the past several years, the Brockton Police Department was able to search the former home of a person of interest in this case.
We excavated a site, you know, within the last 5 years, I'd say. Very nice woman that owns this home where there were some people of interest that used to live there. Actually gave us permission to basically use sonar on the grounds. And then we used a backhoe and dug up basically half this woman's yard, gave us carte blanche, whatever we wanted to do back there. And we excavated more than what people wanted to do at that day. The outcome was not good. Nothing was found. I mean, we can't dig up half the city, obviously, like some people want to. If we had a good witness that says, hey, no, and gives us good reason to believe that her remains are in the area, I'll do everything I can. I'll spend a week out there with an excavator. But we just never really had that. It's the information we receive is just passed along from three people down the line where they're like, oh, this person said that this is where she's buried. And it's nothing concrete. But there have been, you know, there has been searches of bodies of water and land mass areas. Like I said, I just, unfortunately, I just, without a really good witness that was either involved or was heard from the person involved telling us, hey, this is what we should search. It's going to be tough. But, you know, we're still exploring a couple options, and we got a couple things going over the next couple months. You never know. Hopefully it'll pay off. I hope it does for the family.
One complaint we frequently hear from families, especially those with cold cases like Jennifer's, is that their case gets passed from detective to detective, and it feels like they never really get to know the case before it lands on someone else's desk. For Sergeant Corey, this is a frustration for him as well.
A big problem we have is there's just so much turnover in law enforcement, as you know. Yeah, so one person has this case, like Anne, from her disappearance till she retires somewhere around 97, 98. And Mike Damiano, who's a detective, he gets the case and, you know, re-interviews or interviewed a lot of people that were never interviewed. And probably, the best I can guess is, or recollect, is like 2002, somewhere in that area. So then what happens from there is, you know, he's working with troopers. Troopers get reassigned. They get promoted. They move on. They go back to the road. Same with us. Damiano got promoted sometime after I did. I got promoted in 2009. So I don't really know who was assigned the case after that until I came back up in detectives as a supervisor in around 2013. So obviously, and I worked with probably three troopers since I started working on this in 2013. Just for same reason, like I said, they get transferred, they get promoted, they move on. So the case just goes from trooper to officer to detective. And I think that's the biggest problem we've had is why I took over the case back in 2013. I thought I would have the longest longevity instead of giving to somebody that may get transferred or promoted. There was a little stint where I actually went back to the road about another year and a half where I have no idea who was assigned the case for that time. Then I picked it back up about a year and a half later. So obviously a big problem.
Sergeant Corey told us about some theories he's explored while investigating Jennifer's disappearance.
I mean, I would venture to say that from everybody I talked to, she was very open and outgoing, but wasn't the type to get into a car with a stranger if she did get into a car. So it would lead me to believe that she was last with somebody she knew or a friend of somebody she knew. I don't see her hopping into a car voluntarily and going for a ride with somebody. There's always that case she could have been, you know, abducted and, I mean, grabbed and gagged and thrown in a car. That's totally possible. It's a strange case, and as much as I want to believe somebody knew her, is the person responsible for abducting her, I mean, there always is that possibility. It could have been some serial killer that was passing through Brockton at the time and brought her out of state. So, I mean, there's always that possibility. And people like to talk a lot. Some of these people involved have, you know, a history of law enforcement, and they like to show off and spout off at their mouth, and come to find out everything they say is really just lies, just trying to play themselves up. That whole neighborhood, all the way from where Jen lived down Montello Street right up Broad, that whole block right there were all kind of tight, close-knit, at the time friends, and hung out a lot together. I mean, that's what makes you wonder, too. They're not the type of people that you'd think would be, you know, hardcore criminals and keeping their mouths shut. And that's another thing we've discussed in the past about, we just can't believe if somebody closely associated with her was involved, that it has at some point got out to somebody else and then they got back to law enforcement. There has been some things that have come out, but we've pretty much eliminated them as being false. That is something that's come up with us a lot about that. We can't believe somebody has been so quiet. And it makes you believe maybe there was one person involved and just to shut their mouth. But again, in my opinion, if somebody that knew her in that neighborhood was the last person to see her and took her and harmed her, there'd definitely be at least three or four witnesses to that.
As the years have gone on with no answers for Jennifer's loved ones, her sister Yvette decided to start a tradition to honor her memory.
I actually started a new tradition a couple of years ago. She disappeared November 14th of 1989, and we do a vigil walk every year of our neighborhood, basically kind of her last steps of what we think her last steps would have been. That's what we do. And it's a candlelight vigil. We do it every year on the 14th, rain or shine.
So because her birthday is on Christmas, and it was really hard for me for so long to get that Christmas spark back. I mean, I have three kids of my own now, so that kind of helped a little bit. Now what I do is I put up all my Christmas decorations and everything on the 14th, on that day, before I go out and I do my walk. It helps bring the joy back to it and, you know, just feel her there in a more connected way, I guess. That's what I do now. It helps with the grief. The thing with the missing and the unknown and the no closure, it's a constant grief. It never goes away. It doesn't get any better. I mean, it might get a little bit lighter as the years go on, but it's still really hard not knowing. And that's what hurts the most. I have to work on the case. I have to do stuff like I do. Like, I'm a part of Massachusetts Missing now. That stuff helps me to get through it. But I just can't sit here and wait and wait and wait. I have to do something about it. So that's what I do.
So what happened to Jennifer Fay on November 14th, 1989? It is clear that Jennifer was seen throughout the neighborhood by many different people that night. This was a place where parties would pop up in different spots. The various conflicting stories about that night have only added to the confusion. Is this a case where a lot of people know what happened but they've kept quiet? Or are the conflicting stories due to the teens being intoxicated that night? Jennifer was last seen by her family when she came back to the home to grab her jacket. The mother of her friend Kristen has claimed that she showed up on their doorstep, but she also said she turned her away because she smelled like alcohol. Jennifer's family is suspicious of this because Kristen's mom was known to allow the kids to party there. In the days after Jennifer disappeared, Kristen, who was known to be her very best friend, shut down and has never helped with the search efforts or spoken to the family. There's also this other family in the neighborhood who were later found to have kidnapped a young disabled woman and held her captive in their basement. Jennifer was friends with several young men in that family, and it's been theorized that maybe she saw something and was going to go to the police. Beyond those theories, it remains possible that she was taken by someone who spotted her walking around the neighborhood that night. There's a story about how she went to the convenience store with a male friend who got sick from drinking too much, and he decided to go home. She was allegedly spotted walking toward a vehicle. Could she have gotten into a car with a local that she thought she could trust? Many years have passed with no answers for Jennifer's loved ones. There are a lot of rumors and speculation, but no solid proof to point at any one person or persons being responsible. Jennifer's family hopes that someone will feel compelled to come forward and give them the answers they're seeking. If you have any information about the disappearance of Jennifer Fay, you're urged to call the Brockton Police Department at 508-941-0200.
I just feel like the ball was dropped so long ago. I feel like if it was now, they would have solved it immediately. But the fact that it was 30 years ago and just the way the world was back then, and no cell phones and everything else.
The only detective that's ever been 100% honest to us, and he looked me right in the eye, is Charlie. And he said to me and my boyfriend that unless somebody comes forward and says, this is what happened and this is where she is, we'll never bring her home. And I don't think that's ever going to happen. Unless you've, like I said, you've upset a lot of people, and I'm hoping that, like, she's very vocal right now, and she's been taking a lot of trees, so.
They know something, and they've known something all these years, and I just can't understand why they would never come forward and say where she is. Because now these girls have daughters of their own that are actually about the same age as my daughter was when she went missing. I just wish I had some answers. I just wish whoever knows something, which I know they do, would come forward and just let us know where she is so I can bring her home and then go on from there and find out how she got to that place in the first place. You have your holidays, you know, I mean, your Christmas holiday is bad enough, but then when you know your daughter was born on that day, and you don't know where she is. It's been really hard. And I would just, you know, you think after 31 years you'd be used to speaking to people about it, but you know, you can put it on the back burner for a little while, and then something comes up, or you see a picture, or you hear a song, and she's right there. Not that I don't think of her every day anyway. As a matter of fact, I have her picture right now in front of me with a candle. Hoping that somebody will hear this and come forward, I mean.
That brings us to the end of episode 256. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by contributing on Patreon, where you can get early and ad-free episodes. Join me next week. Instead of taking the week off for Thanksgiving, we will be bringing you an update on a case that originally aired in 2018. Thanks for listening.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.